Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 87, recorded September 16th, 2010. Your browser needs a GPU. Thanks and welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware. Thanks for joining us, at least. I'm Ryan Shrout, joined again by the ever-present and powerful Patrick Norton.
Powerful? This is exciting.
We got to build up the essence of the show, right? We got to make people interested and intrigued. What kind of powers does Patrick have this week?
And it's the power to destroy expensive hardware.
That is definitely a gift that you have. I was thinking maybe the power to answer questions and provide information to our listeners as well. But you go with whichever way you want to go.
I'll go with the power to educate and entertain and amuse. I would like to ask everyone to join me in a small moment of silence. At approximately 1:22 last night, I discovered that my long-standing computer speakers, the ever so beloved Klipsch iFi set that has been powering my musical experience by my monitors on and off for the last 5 years, finally died. There will be an autopsy and hopefully a repair later on. But if you could all join me in a moment of silence, because we talk a lot about hardware that fails miserably and almost immediately. But I just want to say this set of speakers has been taking names and kicking ass for the better part of 5 years. And I am just deeply saddened that yesterday they decided to go on to that pile of audio equipment in the sky.
The ether world, so to speak. I actually have a set of those speakers as well. I had them, and they were really, really, really good speakers. Mm-hmm. And Klipsch still makes good stuff. It got kind of like more expensive. Like, they kind of got away from the consumer side of things in terms of PC equipment. But it's probably the only other place we'll talk about having an autopsy and then trying to bring it back to life as well.
So. What was that movie, Reanimator? That's a delightfully creepy, slashery kind of flick if you're feeling bored this weekend. All right. Intel Developer Forum, the premier event for, well, Intel pushing forward the computer hardware industry in the direction that Intel wants the computer hardware industry to go. Ryan, what was the top story?
Top story was without a doubt Sandy Bridge, which is their next generation CPU architecture. Now, this is one of my the Intel Developer Forum is one of my favorite shows, even though it's very obviously Intel centric. There are other people there, but in reality, the big focus is on Intel because Intel is very open about giving you access to engineers and giving you access to the personnel who are making these chips and making these technologies to ask questions, and they provide a lot of open information that I think people would be surprised. A company the size. And the company with, you know, the intellectual property kind of protection that Intel seems to have, that I think most people be surprised that they do this.
They really open the curtains, let people in. They give you direct access to engineers, which I know Ryan knows the feeling. It's like there's engineers that contact you secretly, anonymously. They beg you to never, ever talk about this information publicly, but they wanted you to know why that thing did that when you did this, which is great, because then you no longer have to scratch that itch trying to fix something, because it turns out it's impossible to fix unless you want to, like, you know, rebuild the motherboard from ground zero. But the flip side is, like, Intel is usually pretty good about this. I mean, we were talking to Lloyd Case on Techzilla this week, which just came out, where they had some amazing testing of SSD drives and that they can actually impact performance in games, not just loading the game levels, which is what I always, you know, what I always, it has always been the case, right? But the game levels have gotten so huge, the game basically makes educated guesses to pull more information. And obviously Intel's like, we sell a lot of SSD drives. We want to keep selling a lot of SSD drives. Matter of fact, we want to sell more SSD drives. And what they're saying is, look, these things, these artifacts you see in certain games, we can make those go away if you maybe want to buy an SSD drive. open up the code.
yes, exactly. There's always that kind of aspect to it. It's like, we're going to tell you about our technology, and we're also, of course, going to tell you why our technology is the best technology out there. They talked about SSDs. There wasn't a whole lot about LightPeak. I know a lot of people were kind of asking about that while I was at the show, sending me Twitter messages and stuff like that. It's like, hey, is there anything going on about that? There wasn't a whole lot on that. Right. The Sandy Bridge stuff was pretty cool. This is the processor that's going to be released in early 2011. I think we can all kind of assume that there's a big trade show that happens really early in 2011. Actually, it happens really early every year.
We like to call it the Consumer Electronics Show.
That's a great place to launch new processor lines across desktops and notebooks. And I would imagine we'll see that stuff then. We'll start getting hardware in for testing here in a little bit. But Sandy Bridge is a pretty dramatic shift away from all the other architectures for a couple of key reasons that I'll just go over real quick. The first one, and probably the most dramatic, is the implementation of a GPU core onto the die with the processor. So it's a CPU-GPU combo, and it's not just the Westmere cores, your Arendelle, your Clarkdale's, the processors that are out now in the mobile front and the desktop front that have both graphics and CPU on the same on the same processor, but they're not on the same die. They're not built together. They're not communicating in as directly a way as they are here. And on Sandy Bridge, it's one piece of silicon built around all of this.
Remember the North Bridge and the South Bridge?
It seems so long ago. It seems so long ago that, you know, you had a memory controller on the North Bridge, and you could get different chipsets, and that would affect your memory performance and how fast you could clock things and overclocking. All that, all that's gone. And now, you know, you used
half
to get
the motherboard's
different
chipsets now.
Oh yeah, I mean, it, probably half, but it's like the most important half by far. Memory controller, your graphics. You know, so this is obviously bad news for NVIDIA, who loved making integrated graphics chipsets that they sold to the likes of Apple and other OEMs and things like that. Now, the graphics on this chip are going to be an improvement over any other integrated graphics Intel has done before, but they're not going to be on the level of integrated graphics that you might have seen most recently from Intel or NVIDIA, or I'm sorry, AMD or NVIDIA. So it's definitely an improvement. It's still not a wild improvement in gaming performance. Right. They're much more adamant about touting the media capability of the new processor. There's now dedicated silicon in the processor that will do video encode and decode.
Yes.
So essentially, they showed a demo of a video transcode on a Core i7 processor, a current Core i7 processor versus on a new Sandy Bridge. And it was literally like a 3 or 4x, maybe more, speed improvement on what it was.
This is, I mean, I think Sandy Bridge, obviously it's primarily a notebook part, a laptop part, a mobile part, but it's a low power consumption part, which means it's going to have really great thermal management, which means you don't need big giant fans, which means, you know, okay, so that's good. But when you factor in the fact that they have the hardware for acceleration built into this and the AVX, the new AVX instructions designed to basically accelerate all sorts of different calculations. This is going to be a great home theater part. We were talking about this in 18 Nation and just getting really excited about the idea that instead of having an Atom and then like, okay, the Atom won't actually do 1080p, but the Atom plus the Ion's pretty good as long as you're just playing back 1080p and you're not trying to re-encode anything or manipulating anything. In this case, you really have a fairly powerful part, and in things like, and it also is like, if you're rendering out movies to go to YouTube or the family videos, or if you're, you know, you download, you know, video and you want to change transcode the format to play on your media player, it's going to be fantastic performance wise because it's going to do these incredibly dense calculations without using a big chunk of your CPU and firing up your entire cooling system and making your house sound like a jet engine just took off. I'm actually really stoked about the Sandy Bridge parts, the next gen Core Duo, the next gen Core 2 Core Duo, English 4M language hard.
They just call it like the neck. It's really kind of annoying because their official name for the product, the entire IDF, was the second generation Core microarchitecture processor, codenamed Sandy Bridge.
Does that mean they haven't figured out or do they just want to leave it like it's the core duo? I mean, what's going to happen? I go to shop for one of these. Or are we waiting for CES to find out what the brand name is going to be? Are they trying to find something that doesn't mean like I slaughter elephants in three languages where it's really critical? Now, well, you laugh, right?
It's going to be called Core anyway. It's just going to be Core i5. I think they're still going to keep the i3 and i5 and i7. They're just going to be 4-digit labels instead of 3-digit labels now. Why they didn't want to just tell us that now and kind of get that out in the open. I mean, they don't want to indicate what specific products, what frequencies are going to be out or anything like that. They don't want to announce that until January. And that would kind of go along with the model numbers and that kind of stuff. So
I get a question for you while we're talking about this. What exactly is the next generation Turbo Boost? Because the whole idea of like, what are they changing in Turbo Boost to make it the next generation for the next generation Core Duo micro architecture, which just rolls right off the tongue?
I think they should keep it like that too. So the next generation Turbo Boost is actually kind of cool. So Turbo Boost is the ability for Intel microprocessors based on the Halem architecture, the previous one to this, to scale their frequency up when fewer cores are being utilized because the processor, a quad core processor has a TDP of, let's say, 90 watts. Well, if only two of those cores are running, Intel figured out, well, we can send more current to those two cores, allow them to clock higher than they would normally run and still be at or below that 90 watt TDP rating. This helps. We didn't have to worry about deciding between getting a slower clocked quad core processor or a higher clocked dual core processor. Now you, in theory, had the best of both worlds. The next generation version of Turbo Boost just basically kind of takes that another step further. And the scientific reasoning for the change is in the previous algorithm, the current algorithm, the processor assumed that as soon as it added more power to the processor, that the temperature level was immediately reached, right? So they said, well, if we're going to push this from 70 to 90 watts, well, then we know that the temperature is going to hit X immediately. But in reality, temperatures don't do that, right? It's kind of a gradual rise up. And what they've done is in that time of that gradual rise in temperature, they've actually increased the power even more to the processor that will allow them to get one or two bins faster in frequency. So, maybe 200-400 megahertz faster during like a fixed 20-second period where Intel has decided it's this period where the temperature will rise and then they need to lower it again before it's dangerous. So they lower it again when that temperature gets up to that level to the kind of max TDP.
So it's just so funny, the idea of like they're kind of just ramping it and dropping it and ramping it and dropping it. And I just find that amusing for some reason.
And from what they're telling me, that this will happen pretty often, right? So, it'll go for that 20-second period where they think everything's safe. They're pretty conservative, I would imagine, in their engineering world there. They don't want to have any kind of warranty problems. And then when the processor kind of goes down and is idle more, you kind of recharge the ability to have that extra bit of turbo, right? So the longer your processor's not doing very much, the more likely it will be the next time you open up an application and you'll get that much higher spike in frequency than you would otherwise. It's just kind of cool that there are people that are thinking about that type of thing. They're stretching every bit of performance they can out of the power envelopes they have and the silicon that they have and that kind of stuff. So it was pretty neat. There's a lot to be excited about with Sandy Bridge. I'm sure we'll be talking about it a lot between now and the January timeframe when it comes out.
You've got more information on AMD's, man, I'm going to blow this again, Zacate.
Nope, that's dead on. Dead on.
Well. Sun shines, dog's posterior once in a while. So, I mean, is AMD like, they just seem to be trickling out more and more information about this. AMD was actually doing briefings for press over at IDF, not in the Intel Developer Forum building the Moscone West where the event was held, but they were in hotel suites in the neighborhood.
They always seem to like poach a nice little spot right across the street, easy walking distance, take advantage of all the media that
comes
in.
That's how you get the journalists. That's how you get the Ryan Shrouds to show up.
Just kind of wander across the street. Now, when they started doing this like 6-7 years ago, Intel really hated it and they tried to get it stopped because at that point, AMD actually would like pull up next to the Moscone Center with like a limo and pick people up with like an AMD logo on the limo and stuff and take them out. They don't really do that anymore. So, but what they were showing was actually pretty cool. We talked about APUs. This is their version of a CPU, GPU combination product. The first one that's going to be released is Ontario and Zacate. Very similar designs. Zacate is just kind of like the higher performance full-size notebook version of it. It's an 18-watt part that combines a dual-core processor with a modern DirectX 11 capable GPU in one die. They're not talking specifics about like how many shaders and how performance will relate to other discrete GPUs on the market. Mm-hmm. But we saw some pretty good performance out of a, you know, an 18 watt part total CPU GPU. I mean, they were doing comparisons of a Zacate reference platform against a current Core i5 520M processor. So not Sandy Bridge. They don't have Sandy Bridge parts yet, so they can't compare it to that. But for example, they ran Batman Arkham Asylum and the new City of Heroes version, and they're getting anywhere from 2 to 2.5x the performance of the Core i5 processor for gaming, which has a TDP of 35 watts on their 18-watt Zacate part. So that's really impressive, but it's very indicative of what AMD got with the purchase of ATI, because ATI knows graphics, they know drivers, they know GPU hardware much better than Intel's teams do. I mean, that's just something we have to admit based on what Intel's integrated graphics have been like over the last, you know, 10 years. And it seems like AMD will have a chance with this part, which is, you know, it's going to be aimed both at the netbook market and the notebook market and the really low-cost desktop PCs as well, in comparison to what really the price competition right now today is Atom from Intel. And Atom will have no way of standing up to anything close to what the performance that this Zacate part will have. So it'll be interesting to see what Intel's response is next year, if they're going to try to figure out a way to get Sandy Bridge down to a lower clock speed, low power consumption mode to in order to compete at this level of kind of power consumption and performance. We'll have, you know, something that Intel's not talking about right now. They don't like to adjust their product roadmaps based on competition's parts, at least not publicly. So
right.
we'll probably be waiting until January to see what they're actually going to do for that. But it's pretty cool. It was a pretty cool demonstration of a part that Intel or that AMD has been working on for quite a long time. Basically, since the AMD ATI merger, this is the first fruition of that relationship. So
good to know.
Pretty cool. And actually, interesting enough, for those who don't know, Internet Explorer 9 came out as a beta, I think just yesterday as of when we record this. Thing came out Wednesday of this week. And the reason that's interesting is because one of the demonstrations, one of the performance benchmarks that AMD was initially showing was comparison of IE9 performance on their platform versus Intel's. And the reason that's interesting is because IE9 supports GPU-based rendering. So,
yeah, go ahead. We were talking about this before the show, and it's actually kind of mind blowing, right? The Firefox has been playing around with this, and you look at there's this huge blog post on the internet, basically the Internet Explorer blog, where they're like, you know, they're using both 2D and 3D, like direct 2D, direct 3D, and they're like, okay, so here's what we do. There's content rendering, composing the page, and then composing the page on the desktop. And so they're saying IE9 accelerates content rendering using Direct 2D and the Direct Write subsystems. Page composition uses Direct 3D. And what's interesting is they use the GPU to draw the bitmap images very, very quickly, right? So the idea that pictures pop onto your page a lot faster. And then desktop composition, which is basically the browser, you know, takes the content, puts the page together. And then, of course, the desktop Windows manager has to render out the entire thing over again. Mm-hmm. And, this, you know, the quote from the blogs at msndn.com/b/IE/whatever is because IE9 uses DirectX, and only DirectX, there's a better interaction between IE9 and the desktop window manager, using less GPU memory and resulting in better stability than the browsers that mix different subsystems, which is their way of going, you know, Firefox, we're faster than we are, and thumbing their nose, which is what that horrible gesture was. Sorry about that, everybody. And they're making a big deal. They have full acceleration for the entire display pipeline, to the point where you can actually go into IE9 and there's a checkbox for basically turning on software acceleration instead of hardware acceleration. And it's like, It's an interesting idea. Like, so is it DX10 or DX11 for the acceleration was part of the thing I was trying to figure out on that one.
I think it supports both. It's using a D2D, Direct 2D, which is actually something new that Microsoft created in order to developers to be able to write code for the GPU without having to know the really kind of complexities of Direct 3D. So they kind of like made a
CUDA killer, as it were.
Yeah. I don't want to say
I would not want to be at NVIDIA right now looking 5 years out. That's something Lloyd Case was talking to me about that, because this is basically means that, you know, they're rendering directly to the graphics card. They're not using, you know, graphics. Basically, they're, you know, it's like exactly what they did with gaming. Wow, 15 years ago, where they created DirectX to create a standard developer interface. But it's also a really big deal for HTML5 and video acceleration, which is also thumbing their nose at Adobe Flash and the howling fans of my wife's MacBook when she's trying to, you know, deal with Flash advertising in the background.
Right. Yeah. So, but from everything I'm told by guys at AMD who are really excited about this because they think it'll make their really low-power APU stand out against Intel's integrated GPUs and their Sandy Bridge architectures, is that, you know, the render engine's completely changed with this. It's, you know, now you'll be able to do, like, anti-aliasing on text and stuff like that that you wouldn't be able to do. When somebody told me today that it's interesting is in Windows 7, like the default installation, we all know that the Windows interface is now kind of 3D accelerated. It's accelerated by the GPU, started in Windows, completed in Windows 7. The only thing left is like web browsing in terms of default standard applications that come on a Windows 7 install is the last thing that wasn't GPU accelerated, the actual render engine inside of it. And so that's being addressed. IE9's doing it, and then the next version of Chrome and Firefox are planning on it too. So
that's a big
good
deal.
News for GPU makers, at least for now. For now,
it's a good thing. Should we fire up some viewer questions?
Yeah, let's jump into a collection of email questions. I do want to point out here as we get started, though, we have a new email address. I believe that's set up, right?
Yes.
Twitch at twit.tv. TWICH. No T in there. No, there's only one T. TWICH. At twit.tv. Send your emails there now as opposed to directly to me. That way, both Patrick and I can get the emails and we can kind of filter through them. And decide which ones we want to answer and throw up here on the question. So let's go ahead and start into that process, shall we?
We have a question from Chris. He's looking for an iFinity suggestion. He says, I'm new to the whole iFinity thing, which is multiple monitors powered on, you know, like three or more monitors. We're like 40. I'll let you explain it, Ryan. Chris says, I'm new to the whole iFinity thing. I want to know what's the best card for only three screens. I want to be able to game at a minimum of 5760 by 1080 at 25 frames per second. I would like something under $230 Canadian, which last I checked would be around $200-something US. I would like to know if I will need to upgrade or what I will need to upgrade to do this. So he's got a Phenom 2 1090T, 8 gigabytes of DDR3 dual channel RAM, a M4A USB 3.0 motherboard, M4A89 GT Pro, a 60 gigabyte hard drive, 430 watt power supply, 200 millimeter fan, yada, 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 and two Blu-ray drives. He thinks I will need a new power supply, but I don't know what I should get. He's running a 430 watt power supply. I wonder what he's using for the GPU now.
Well, see, that's what he's asking is for a new graphics card.
Got it.
So I assume he basically doesn't have anything now that can support iFinity, which is a Radeon 5000 series feature. I did a quick search. So if we're looking at like a $200 US budget, the most powerful AMD 5000 series video card you can get is the Radeon HD 5830. That will support three GPUs, or I'm sorry, that will support three monitors, one of which will have to be either a DisplayPort monitor, or now that we know you have, or they have the low-cost active DisplayPort to DVI adapters that will be about, I think I saw them on Newegg today for $27. So that's much less than the $100 that they were before. So the Radeon 5830 looks like the option I would go with there. You know, the more money you spend, the better it's going to be, especially when you're talking about a resolution of 5760 by 1080. Depending on what games he's playing and what image quality settings, you know, you're going to have to adjust all that in order to get acceptable frame rates. 25 is pretty low, unless you're playing like a first-person or real-time strategy games or something like that.
I would still want to be going for like 60 frames per second or higher.
If you're in a shooter game, I feel like 60 is like that level you want to hit, and like minimum should never go below 30. RTS games, 30 is probably more than acceptable. You know, if he's trying to do StarCraft 2 or something like that, you know, that'll work. The next level card up is the 5850 from AMD, and that's going to be $250. So that's, you know, fairly far outside of his range. And let me see, based on his motherboard there, doesn't look like it's an SLI motherboard. So I wouldn't even, I was thinking about maybe recommending a pair of something else for NVIDIA as well. But for $200, AMD has the only options there in terms of being able to support three displays and Eyefinity Gaming. So
good to know.
Let's see. We got another email here from a different Ryan about notebook CPU for gaming. He says, Twitch is hands down my favorite show on the Twit network.
Cool.
That's always good news. He says, I'm looking to buy a new laptop. I know for a fact that I want something with a Core i7 processor, but I'm not really sure which chip in that series would be the most beneficial. He wants to do moderate amount of gaming, a lot of the new and upcoming games, but he doesn't expect to get 900 frames per second at the highest settings. That's good, because I don't think that's going to happen. But he also wants to go to Photoshop, no problems, utilize overall media functionality, all that kind of stuff. It says he's looking at two different processors. One is a Core i7-740QM and then the 840QM. And he says the differences are the 740 runs at 1.73 gigahertz base clock, and then the turbo boost up to 2.93. And then the other processor starts at 1.86 with a turbo boost of 3.2. So we're talking about 133 megahertz difference at the base, and then about 260 megahertz at the top speed. He says the pricing difference is $300, and he wants to know, is it worth it to spend the extra money or to save that money and put it towards an SSD? Mm-hmm. And I think this is a question that either of us could easily answer and say that $300 for 200 megahertz, not a worthwhile investment for most.
You know, it always sounds like it's faster, but the reality is that's going to be what? I mean, I 10%, 8%, 5% on the benchmarks?
Because he's talking about for gaming. So I would imagine it'd be even less, you know, noticeable on gaming. Really, even for a notebook, the GPU is still your most important factor when it comes to purchasing a game. So I would get the lower cost CPU, save that $300 either towards, you know, getting a nice SSD, or if there's another way to upgrade the GPU option you have in that notebook. You know, he doesn't give any details on what the two he's looking at there are, but it might be beneficial to look at what the two different GPU options you have are, or if there's more than two options. But I think anybody who's used SSDs will say, if you can afford to put one in your system, you probably should.
Yes.
They're just fun.
Yes, they are. They make us very happy. Speaking of happy, it's kind of funny. We got a question from David, which is particularly well-timed because I had a bunch of friends I hang with on an email thread called the Nerds List, and me and another guy have been kind of elevating the audio levels of some of the other guys in the thread in the last couple of weeks, basically upgrading headphones. And David emails in, "Hey, Ryan and Patrick, I have a question for you guys about headphone amps. I keep hearing people say that you need a headphone amp to get the best sound quality out of your headphones, but when I look up information on them, I have a hard time making sense of all the audiophile language that goes way over my head. For my computer, I have a pair of Sennheiser HD595s, very nice set of headphones, that I connect directly to my Creative X5 sound card. My question is, what do headphone amps accomplish in terms that an idiot like me would understand? And when should you be using one, if not always? Also, if it would be better to be using one in my situation, do you have any recommendations for a mid-range amp that would be good for me? Thanks for any advice you can give. Love the show." Thanks, David. Okay. So if I'm going to use the like bone simple metaphor, I have a race car. The more torque I have in the race car, the faster that thing accelerates, right? Because torque is the twisting power that goes through the transmission, which goes to the wheels, which, you know, there's a distributor in there somewhere. the idea that the more power, right, you have in your car engine, assuming you have traction on the asphalt, the faster the car will move forward, right? That's why those big 4-second, you know, times on the quarter mile drag strips are done by cars with 2,000 horsepower engines and not 125 horsepower engines like you find in your average Econobox. So to take that metaphor, you know, Your headphones, your cans, your speakers are a transducer. It's something that converts electrical energy into sound energy. Whoa. Ryan, are you okay?
Something fell over here. I think I kicked over a cake. That's okay.
Medic! So here's the thing, right? Because basically, electrical energy, you have electrical energy going in the coil, which moves the magnet back and forth. There's a big magnet inside of your headphone, right, or your speaker, and there's two little wires that go to the coil at the base of the speaker, right? So electrical energy hits that coil, and it responds to the big giant magnet. Now, you're basically the sound coming through the cable, the electrical energy coming through the cable basically kicks the speaker forward and back, fills it full of vibrations that go out through the air. The amplifier for big, full-on, burly audiophile headphones, they're often have fairly high loads for a headphone, and the amplifiers you usually find in consumer electronics, whether it's a Walkman going old school, or you know, a portable CD player going slightly less old school, or an early iPod, they don't have the motive energy. They don't have the power to drive a big burly set of headphones. So while you might hear something on the headphones, when you put on these big burly audiophile headphones, when you put an amplifier in between the iPod and the big burly audiophile headphones, all of a sudden your bass tightens up. Maybe you have a little bit more dynamic range. Things get less sloppy. The image tightens up. I'm a huge fan of a company called Headroom, and they do some fantastic fantastic headphone amps. And of course, Headroom.com is not their headphone.com is their website. Since I've been shopping there for 15 years, I should know that. But they have, for a nice entry-level device, if you go down to headphone amps on their webpage, they have something called the Headroom Total Airhead. It's $100. Not cheap, but it's still well under half what you paid for your headphones. What I really like is the Headroom Total Bithead. It's $160. It's a portable device, and what it does is it'll take a USB input from your computer, right? So it'll take the USB audio, goes into it, and use the DAC, the digital to analog converter, inside of the Headroom Total Bithead, which I guarantee you probably sounds a lot better than most notebook computers. Maybe not your X-File, though I'm not a huge creative fan in terms of music. But the idea is that in this case, you get a DAC and a headphone amp. If you don't want to spend a lot of money and you're kind of curious whether or not a headphone amp will actually make things sound better, I would highly, highly recommend checking out something called the Chumoy amplifier. And there's a really good site called tangentsoft.net. And if you search for the Chumoy pocket amplifier, it uses some very inexpensive parts. Basically, you breadboard out this little tiny amplifier, runs off a 9-volt or some AA batteries, depending on how you configure it. And it's actually a really high-quality headphone amp that you can build. You know, basically one of the HeadFi is a online board for can enthusiasts, headphone enthusiasts. And this guy came up with a really clean design for a headphone amplifier that's super easy to build. If you've never soldered before, this is a great way to learn how to solder and build projects. You have a really nice set of headphones. You know, if you build the Chumoy amp and you don't like it, okay, you know, you've lost maybe $20 in parts in a couple hours of time. If you do something with like the Headroom amps, the Airhead's a pretty good way to start. It's $100. It's pretty entry level that way. You might notice that it really brings things together. You might not like it. If you don't like it, you can send it back. Something that's also really cool about Headroom is they have sort of a crossfeed circuit, which is really interesting, in that they put a, and I do not like audio processing for the most part. It drives me nuts, especially on my stereo music recordings. But the crossfeed that Headroom does in their amplifiers is really interesting. It's basically they have a couple of four whatever milliseconds of delay, so that, you know, normally if I'm sitting in front of speakers, this ear hears stuff from both speakers, the left and right channel, and this ear hears stuff from both the left and right channel. And what the crossfeed circuit, if you turn it on, it bleeds, you know, like a few milliseconds later, it bleeds some of this sound into this ear and this sound into this ear. And what it does is it more naturally emulates what you hear when you're listening to the real world rather than separated channels on headphones. It can be considerably less fatiguing,
right,
if you're listening for a long time. And it can also, some people like the way it sounds. So that's probably way more information than anybody ever wanted on this. You know, I could go on about, you know, outboard DACs and headphone amplifiers and headphones. But I will say, if especially on notebooks, other than like some of the Dell Minis, which have some of the best onboard audio chipsets I've heard in a long time, at least the earlier ones, like the one I own, most notebook audio could use help. And it's actually shocking.
That's true.
How mediocre many of the chipsets used on motherboards. So if you're really into music, I'd really suggest, you know, thinking about upgrading your audio card or going to an outboard digital analog converter, which can be super cheap. And if you're a super headphone nerd like I am, you might want to try getting a headphone amp for your headphones. Those $595s might really enjoy a little bit of an audio boost from an amplifier, but I don't think it's necessary. You know, I don't think it's like, dude, you shouldn't be listening without them. But that's a really nice set of headphones, dude. You should be enjoying those.
Very cool.
Too much information. Sorry.
It was interesting information. I didn't know. I never knew why I would need a headphone amp to begin with. So I
basically, it's more power to move the cone and the speaker back and forth. You know, move it more precisely, faster, right. More better.
More betterish. Yeah, we've already used that as a show title, and we can't do that again. Let's see. We've got an email from Don about an AMD CPU upgrade. This should be a little bit more straightforward. He says he has a system with an AMD Phenom 9600. It's an ASRock 780 chipset, 128M board. I believe that's the one with integrated graphics. But since the 9600 has the TLB, I think he meant to say there, he can't play StarCraft II. With much going on before the performance suffers or completely stops until nearly everything is dead. Says he's been looking to upgrade the CPU, so he's been keeping his eye on the Phenom 2 X6 1090T, which is a 6-core AMD processor. Would it be worth getting one of those, as my MOBO supports AM3 CPUs, or are there more AM3 CPUs in the pipeline that would be a better choice or cause the prices of the current models to drop? I don't know a whole lot about the upcoming roadmap for what AMD is doing here, but I do not expect there to be a large push of processors on the current Phenom architecture anytime soon from AMD. I think what we have now is pretty much what we're going to get. We might get a couple of frequency bumps or something. I'm just looking at Newegg, the Phenom 2 X6 1090T sells for $279. That's a pretty good price. There is another one, the 1055T is a 2.8 gigahertz instead of a 3.2 gigahertz, still a 6-core processor, and it's $197. So you're talking about $80 less for, again, that 400 megahertz difference. Both of these parts are going to be much faster than the older Phenom 9600 that he has. And StarCraft II is definitely one of those games that uses the CPU power or the CPU more than most other titles. It's still GPU dependent, but it's also...
Is it multi-threaded in that it'll take advantage of all the cores on that Phenom 2 X6, or is it still primarily a single channel?
It's not really that multi-threaded. Sorry. I might think it might be 2 or 3 threaded, because we looked in that when we were trying to figure out what was going on performance-wise, and my theory was that because Blizzard likes to make their games that will go back much, much further in terms of hardware support, that they didn't really push multi-threaded on it very much. It still was pushing 2 or 3 active at a time, but it wasn't, you know, pegging 2 or 3 at a time, and it definitely wasn't going on to 6. But having six threads will give him the ability to run more things in the background. The operating system can handle that as well. And also, I mean, these Phenom 2 architecture CPUs are going to be faster than the original Phenoms that he's on right there. So I would recommend the 1055T that's under $200. If he's okay with the extra $80, he wants that 400 megahertz. I mean, you're going to see performance difference there, but it just depends on whether or not that's worth the $80 difference for you.
So worth the VIG. Man. We have another Ryan emailing. That's crazy. Ryan, yet another Ryan emails. I'm looking for a new laptop. Listening to you and Patrick on Twitch, I'm wondering about USB 3.0. You should. It's epically awesome. Should I make sure my next laptop, which I plan to have for 2 to 3 years, has USB 3.0? These seem to be slowly coming up from the likes of Asus. That just doesn't sound right. If I wait a few months, will it be widely available? Thanks. Really enjoy the show, Ryan. I don't know if it's going to be next year for widely available on USB 3.0.
Yeah.
Or do you think by the end of this year? It seems a little, it seems a little rising curve. I mean, you still have to like mail order a USB 3.0 hub because I can't find any locally. I can find USB 3.0 PCI Express cards. Hmm. I can find USB 3.0 drive enclosures.
Right.
But hubs and cables are really difficult to find. I'm thinking I'm thinking it's going to be next year. All these new notebooks coming out, Sandy Bridge, the new AMD notebooks. I think that's where you're going to start finding USB 3.0, because also the chipsets are still kind of pricey. They haven't really scaled down the chipsets in terms of
USB
price.
3 kind of hit the desktop world all at once in terms of all these new motherboards were coming out with it. I know with Sandy Bridge motherboards that are coming out, I'm seeing those designs already, and they're gonna have 4 and maybe 6 USB 3.0 ports instead of the 2 that pretty much everything that exists today with USB 3.0 support has. So that's good. On the notebook front, he's right. There have been a handful of Asus models that have come out that have had it, and I think a couple of others, but it hasn't really jumped on as much. Notebook design cycles are fairly long. So they're always kind of the last to adopt these types of things. Also kind of disappointing is that the upcoming Intel chipsets still aren't going to support USB 3.0. So
why? Or they just must think it's too early.
I mean, this is Intel's fault. I have no other answer other than to say that this is Intel's fault. No reason that I can think of why you wouldn't support USB 3.0 on here on their upcoming 6 series chipsets for Sandy Bridge. Now, they're still saying almost all of their partners are planning on including third-party chip to do USB 3.0 support. I would expect most notebooks that come out in the January-February timeframe to have USB 3.0, but I can't guarantee it. It's not like if it was on an Intel chipset, I'd tell you they're all going to have USB 3.0. But because it's an external chip that's required, some will have it, some won't. I think more will have it. And I think, the notebooks that we have out today that will be out from now until, November, December timeframe were designed last year. And the ones that are going to come out in January, February, once Sandy Bridge products start to roll out, have been designed in the last 6 months. So that is when I think you'll be able to find a whole host of them with USB 3.0 support. So if you look at the USB 3.0 models today and you're not really happy with what they have and you're okay waiting, especially, he says in this email that this is one he's going to keep for, 2 to 3 years, then I would wait until that January, February timeframe before jumping on to just buy one otherwise, right? Because I do think USB 3.0 is important. I do think it's a kick-ass technology that everybody should have on their computer now. That way everybody will be making accessories for it and stuff too. So Patrick can find them locally.
That's all I want, man.
Patrick to find them locally.
It's all about being able to buy locally and support my local hardware store. Although my local store, Central Computer, is pretty epic, but... Oh boy, Carl has a question about a high performance monitor. I'm looking to buy a new 24-inch monitor with less than 8 milliseconds latency. That's actually pretty easy, but I do not want a TN or twisted pneumatic panel. Do you have any suggestions? For anybody who's not super familiar with what's going on in TFT flat panel design, twisted pneumatic is pretty common. It's cheap. And it's the response times. It's actually amazing. Like, 5-6 millisecond response times are pretty common out of most monitors being sold today. Twisted-O-Matic is an interesting idea. I'm not going to try to explain the finer points of the architecture, but Twisted-O-Matic displays, and you'll usually find it buried deep in the details or the technical specs, if you're like right. on the Dell website. But there's some issues with basically the viewing angles are much smaller than other TFT technologies, especially actually if you're going vertical. So if you don't have a lot of movement on your desktop, it can be really frustrating. But the colors shift really badly, which can be really frustrating. More importantly, TNT panels generally use, and I'm going to quote Wikipedia on this because if I don't, I'll screw it up. TN panels most, not all, but most TN panels represent colors using only 6 bits per RGB color or 18 bits in total and are unable to display the 16.7 million color shades or 24-bit true color that are available from graphics cards. So basically, they interpolate 24-bit color. They dither the color. It basically means they fake the color. They estimate the color to make it fit into the TN technology. So that's just a giant bag of suck. The other technology that you're finding a lot these days is IPS or in-plane switching, comes out of Hitachi. Right. And it's basically the engineers at Hitachi were basically noticing that Twisted-O-Matic was kind of a bag of suck that they wanted to improve on. So that the crystal modules in an IFS frame basically move parallel to the plane instead of perpendicular to it. But it basically gives it really good, you know, wide angle viewing from a bunch of different angles and also makes for really accurate colors. So IFS is probably something you're going to be looking for on a high performance monitor, Carl. You've heard me say it 1,000 times. I love buying from the Dell outlet. I love Dell monitors. Dell buys a lot of glass. They buy it in volume, so they have really good deals. Samsung also I'm pretty happy with. The ST2410, which is a full HD widescreen monitor. I'd skip the one with the stereo bar because I want real speakers. But that's just me, man. But that's going to be like 1920 by 1080, 24 inches. And that one is running at, you know, I saw it 5 milliseconds for the response times claimed. Not the brightest monitor on the planet, 250 mm-hmm. Candelas per meter squared, but good if you're not in super bright sunlight. Yeah, the ST2410, and if you're a video editor or big into Photoshop, I suggest you check out Dell's UltraSharp lineup. Those are the cool guy monitors. If you're into super color accuracy, that's using in-plane switching. These are 1920 by 1200 in terms of the resolution, 400 candelas per meter square, which means they hold up a lot better under bright lights, and 6 millisecond response times, 178 degree vertical and horizontal viewing angles, which means you can, I don't know, slouch in your chair a lot and still read everything. But they're claiming like, the UltraSharp, they quote the support and compatibility with industry color space. So they're claiming they've got 96% coverage of Adobe RGB. sRGB emulates 72% of NTSC color because the color gamuts don't really overlap between different technologies, which is a bizarre conversation I don't want to get us started onto. But that one's pretty pricey. That's selling for $500.
Yeah, but that's a problem with the non-TN panels really in general.
Yeah. The Twisted-O-Matic panels are the ones where you're getting a 24-inch panel for under $300. But yeah, I'm liking the Dell, the 2410, the UltraSharp, which is the U2410. And they're still doing – oh, good. They are still doing the G2410, which is – let me just double-check one last thing.
Oh, I do see that one. Okay.
I'm so
looks
sorry
like
to be
376
here.
Or something like that.
Yeah, and that's a TFT. That's a TFT. I think that one is a non-TN monitor. But yeah, the ST2410 and the U2410, I think are kind of that would be my big two choices. Which makes me want to run over to the Dell outlet and check the pricing on that. Why don't you answer Sean's?
I will do that.
Question, and I'll go look to see what the outlet price is on that because
I can do
I
that.
Just love my Dell outlet.
I can handle that assignment. Let's see. We've got an email from Sean about MacBook, about a Mac notebook for games. It says he has an older MacBook, the white book, with the Intel Integrated Graphics GMA X31 running Windows in boot camp. He is unable to play the games I used to play on my old Windows notebook, which had an ATI HD 2600 GPU. The games he plays most of the time are Far Cry, Crysis, Delta Force, COD4. He's thinking about buying another MacBook and giving this one to his son to use. His question is if the latest MacBook with the integrated Intel GeForce 320M will be good enough to get decent frame rates on these games, or would I need to upgrade to the 15-inch MacBook Pro with the NVIDIA GeForce GT 330M? He's not expecting super high frame rates, just want the games to look decent and playable. The integrated GeForce 320M will definitely be an improvement over the HD 2600, and it will be obviously a big upgrade over the GMA X31. So I think for those titles, not maxed out image quality settings, the integrated 320M will probably be good enough. My only thing would be the 15-inch panel might be better for gaming than the 13-inch panel. Just for me, unless he's connecting it to an external display or something, to me the advantages of that a 15-inch screen on a notebook for gaming would might be worth the extra $200 or $300. I'm not sure what that gap is right now, but definitely I think those GPUs are advanced enough to play those games at reasonable quality settings. I mean, Crysis is still up there. It's still Crysis. There are still graphics cards out today that can't play it very well at its high quality settings, but put everything in its medium range and I don't think it'll be any type of problem with that. So
good to know, man.
And did you hit up the outlet?
yes, I did. I should probably order one of these before I tell you about it, but the Dell refurbished ultra-sharp U2311H 23-inch widescreen flat panel display with 100% more cool, which is technically an inch smaller than you want, but is costing less than half the price of the brand new 24-inch ultra-sharp. It's $250 for a 23-inch flat panel. The G2410H, if you're not familiar with the Dell outlet, they do refurbished. They do stuff that's been returned, open box, scratch and dent, depending on what you're looking at. But basically, they offer you a pretty good deal if you shop carefully. But yeah, ultra-sharp, 23-inch ultra-sharp for $250, 24-inch G-series widescreen flat panel, and I want to say that one. Yeah, 5 millisecond response time, TFT attribute matrix. That's $229.
Alienware. So there are more options out there than I really thought there were originally. So.
Yeah, oh, hey, I got to order a monitor real quick because my 21.5-inch ultra shot for $200 are back in stock. But now I can get an inch and a half more space for just $40 more.
Exactly.
I'm really into the whole dual monitor lifestyle right now. But yeah, Carl. Oh, yeah. Definitely check out the UltraSharps, check out the Dell outlet. I've got a bunch of computers from there and monitors from there. I've been really happy. And yeah, 8 milliseconds, easy. And twisted pneumatic, it just means you're going to be paying more to get your monitor.
Yep.
So
agreed.
We had a crazy question from Chris about distributed HDMI. My initial reaction, I don't want to get into it because I'm pretty sure the only easy way to do what Chris wanted to do is to hire an installer to program a really sophisticated thing for you, which basically requires a lot more money than I think anybody wants to spend who listens to this show. But I'm going to investigate that a little bit more. Maybe we'll revisit that question next week.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. Let's do that. Let's do that. Yeah. That one I put in there. I knew it was going to either was going to have a really easy answer or was going to require a little bit of research to figure out all about the HDMI to Cat 5 issues there. So it's like those systems that you see run at maybe your local BW3 where you've got 50 TVs all running off of a couple of projectors and stuff like that. Very complex, usually very expensive systems. Yeah. So we're going to close the show out now. It's been great answering everybody's questions. Again, we want you to share your email or share your questions with us through email, rather, twitch@twit.tv. And of course, you can follow Patrick and I on Twitter and submit some questions that way. I am at Ryan Shrout, and Patrick is equally creatively named at Patrick
Norton.
Yeah,
that's too late to get just at Patrick, but I think actually one of the Twitter founding crew is at Patrick.
Okay.
PCPer.com is the legendary website where Ryan – well, actually, if you're looking at Ryan's giant pile of hardware, which you can't really see because he hides it when he's recording the podcast.
It's all behind the camera. It's all behind the camera. I think I kicked some of it over earlier in the show.
That was that horrible clanging noise. I didn't want to scream yeah. medic at the top of my lungs. Yeah, PCPer.com yeah. is where we find Mr. Shrouts. You can find me at techzilla.com or hcnation.tv. And if you want to learn more about the solid-state disk drives and performance, check out Techzilla. It just came out on Thursday this week at techzilla.com, which is – oh, and I finished the burning machine, the Rip Monster 3000.
Yeah.
Turns out I ran out of drives after 7 drives. Turns out you can record at least 7 different drives through DB Power. So I was ripping, like, the combined ripping speed was like up to 150-160x when you have like 6 discs going simultaneously. Also, it's amazing. A single USB drive will take CPU usage from like 6 SATA drives. Encoding, ripping and encoding simultaneously to Apple lossless, 15% of CPU, adding in a 7th drive over the USB bus, cranks that up to almost 25-30%.
Wow.
USB 2.0, not processor friendly, but invented by Intel, so it keeps people moving for faster processors.
Good point. Good thinking on their part. We will see you next week. If you want to watch us record the show live, you can do that every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. Or you can pass on this show to all of your tech head friends, anybody that might want a little bit more information about computers and hardware. Just send them to twit.tv/Twitch and they can subscribe, which through the audio, video, both, anything they want to do there. So we thank you guys for watching and or listening to this episode of Twitch, and we'll see you next week.